So people can see their name up. They can owner satisfied if they want to see their overheads on the screen as well. Steve and I split the topics into about six different threads that we split across the week, and I'll say a little bit about each of them, and I'll highlight a couple of the talks. And then at the end, I'll come back and look to the future a bit more and see a few lessons that we learned. One of the things about commodity computing is it's not that great for photographs, right? I mean, it's boxes. It's typically, some of the boxes are a bit different color. Some of them are a bit shinier, but there's a lot of boxes. And, I think next time, I think everyone feels the need that they have to show, you know, their boxes. I was a bit impressed by Slack. I visited there last year, and they have probably the most color-coordinated machine room I've seen. They have a nice uniform blue everywhere. I'm not sure how much they had to pay for that. On the first session on compute farms, I'm going to just list the talks, each one in a font that you can read this time. I'll jump back and forward on a few. D0 seemed to have the best names for a software. I think with their Dobbin and their Doom and things like that, they've stolen a march over CDF there. They also have quite a nice tool for looking and monitoring their farm, so they can see what's happening, all the various jobs, things that are running on the farm. They can see the CPU utilization, things like that. Of the others, so what did we learn? We learned that there are lots of compute farms out there. Everyone who needs serious compute power seems to have got in and be putting together Linux systems. They're growing. Everyone that does a new one, they're bigger and more than the rest. And you know, existing experiments, Zeus and people like that, they've moved to Linux farms for their work. All the new experiments are planning compute farms based on PC hardware. And no one seems too worried about whether they're able to meet the CPU requirements. And certainly for the, you know, RIC, Run 2 experiments, and Compass, the ones that are just starting up soon, seem fairly confident that just by spending enough money they can put in enough compute power. Everyone still seems surprised in comments on how powerful PCs are and how cheap they are compared with, you know, what they had to pay for the computing a few years ago. Just mention a couple of points on, this is a diagram of CDF's data flow, and they're actually splitting their physics into about eight different streams of data, and then each of those get farmed out into, I thought it was eight actually, different streams. So, you know, the data flow is quite complex. Having been farmed out like this, it then gets resorted and amalgamated again. So it's quite a complex handling of data as it goes through their farm. Compass, I think the thing to observe here is they're almost ready to run. They seem to feel they've met their objectives. They're looking for 35 megabytes a second. And you can see here, this is number of streams they're writing, and they're achieving up to like 50, perhaps 60 megabytes a second. You can see this peak here at 40 megabytes a second. So they're proving that they can achieve the rates they want, writing through the farm, reconstructing, and writing into objectivity. I think that's the important point on this one. Hera B, again, they've now summarized this as saying they've got, you know, started online event reconstruction using a farm. MAP, the Monte Carlo Array processor at Liverpool, which is mainly for LHCb, that is 300 processors. What's different about it is they've tried to make it lowest cost as possible. So they don't have switches, they don't have, you know, they've got cheapest network cards they can find, commodity processors. And they're looking at extending that now with disk. So it's a real cut-down model. What it does is it generates n-tuples. So you can generate, you know, a million events in a week with a summary for detector design. So it's not part of a full, you know, doesn't have an ongoing reconstruction chain beyond it. But I think it's a useful model. The other thing they did is, just to test the scalability for the future, throughout thousands of nodes, they actually broadcast the jobs. So when the master node says, I want you all to run this program, it uses broadcast techniques across the network. Okay. Slightly ad hoc distinction between the compute farms and the big systems, but you know, mainly these are compute farms as well, but they tend to be a bit more implemented with, you know, more data management, things like that. And I think the lessons there are that these are big, right? We've got some really, but the long-term demands of these are really quite large. Rick seemed fairly confident that they're ready for a petabyte a year when they start data taking. So the other points to note are the CPUs are all commodity in these systems. They're all, mainly all based on PCs. Most of them are not commodity disk or tape, right? Except for Fermilab's model is to go to, well, they're not decided on the actual tape yet for run two, but they think it'll be, you know, it's a commodity type. It'll be AIT or Exabyte Mammoth, something like that. But most of the rest of people are using storage tech, Redwoods, things like that. And I'll mention a little bit more about Reckon CCJ in a minute. Ammon Nile thing looks something to follow. It's a Java-based fault-tolerant distributed operating system, and it's a project to use Nile to use up spare resources on other computers. So again, it's firing off with Java. So it's similar to Conda. This is the Riken Computer Center in Japan. You can see they've got substantial resources there. The data flow is both via tape from Brookhaven and across the wide area network. And they've been doing some tests using very large TCP window sizes now, and they've been achieving, well, 5 megabits a second, which is not fantastic, and you know, maybe some investigations to why it's not up at the theoretical maximum, but for long distance transfers like that, it's quite good. I'll just go back a bit. I mean, I think the applicability of this is the sort of thing you'll be doing with grid work over long distances. I mean, within the US, you may have very high bandwidths, but it's not so obvious what we'll have over the international lines. Just to show that for Rick, you know, they want the large amounts of data, large amounts of online storage by next year. And they think they can do it all with, you know, this well-specced hardware. One thing, I'll come back to this in a minute, but one of the points of the data system at Fermilab is they're looking at using a caching. I thought this was worthy of note because it's a collaboration between Fermilab and DAISY. I'll say a bit more about that. The next section on tools for batch farms, this is where we looked at the things, not so much the administration tools, but, you know, visualization, monitoring, batch systems, things like that. Jefferson Lab, well, we had a talk from Platform on LSF earlier in the week, but there's also been a lot of comments within the community on how the pricing model for LSF doesn't really scale to the thousands of processors that we're looking at. And in fact, it's very heavyweight software for the sort of things you actually want to do on a compute farm, which is really just fire off one job per CPU and keep them busy and keep it queued and scheduled properly. So Jefferson Lab reported that they've been looking at PBS as a replacement for LSF and that it seems quite feasible to do that. They've also looked at putting a user interface layer above both systems so that the user doesn't really know which they're doing. Right, so the user doesn't have to. So you could have in the center that can afford it, you could have LSF. The same experiment, perhaps in a university, might be using PBS, but you can have a layer that hides this from everyone. So that looks worthy of further study by other labs. Rick reported on a Java-based agent that would go around various things in a farm and take performance measurements. And this is the visualizer tool for it that shows, you know, it's showing you, I think this was just the data load, the file access on a particular node as a function of time. So being able to see these sort of things from a central place for the farm and look at various performance tools with performance measurements looked like a useful facility. Under administration and management, that's the various talks. Couple I'll highlight. Well, my summary on that is that there's very strong interest in Linux administration. You wouldn't have thought there were that many Linux administrators around, but this particular session completely filled the room we had. People were sitting in the aisles. There were a number of people got turned away, just couldn't get in. So we should have obviously had a bigger room for that session. be interesting to see whether there's, you know, more or less interest next time. I wouldn't have thought that many people wanted to be Linux system administrators, but there we go. The sort of things people were putting forward were solutions for, you know, installation of Linux systems, management of Linux, monitoring of clusters and farms, tracking distributed jobs through the system. How can you tell what you know, what's actually going on? And things like printing and batch systems. So CERN are using Kickstart, which is a very good method. Once you've implemented it, once you've got the system that you want to be installed and got the Kickstart configuration correct, it's very easy. It just fires out and installs on large numbers of systems. However, there are some problems. To actually develop the Kickstart file can be quite difficult. And you've got somehow got to manage all the different configurations. You need one of these for each, not for each machine, but for each different type of machine and configuration hardware. So if in a big site you've got a lot of different requirements, a lot of different hardware, then you need some sort of method of managing all the different Kickstart things that are going. Similar model from Fermilab, their SysTracker project. That said, well, we don't assume to actually install the system. You take a base installed Linux system, and then you track the changes that happen to it. Now, there's two uses for that. One is, I mean, I think the point is that they're not hardwiring their systems. They're not tying them down. Users want some sort of control over a Linux system. And the trouble is, when they've made the changes, this can have an effect on it. And if you're trying to support these systems, you know, you get a bit of conflict there. So what they're doing is looking at tracking the changes that have happened in the systems. And there's two sort of methods for, two uses for that. You can either look at, roll back what's happened on a particular box, right? If something's gone wrong, you can roll back to a known system and be in the right sort of configuration. Or you can use the fact that you've got a model for a base system plus a number of, you know, known changes to it, and then you can use that to do an installation onto a brand new system. So if, you know, this particular method could be developed. I don't think they've done that yet, but it could be developed into a system similar to the Kickstart that they're using it. So when I saw this one, this is Babar's project to put to move to Linux as a supported operating system. My first thought was, well, I hope they're happy together. The second one was, what's the big deal? Every other experiment, as we've heard from all the talks, is using Linux. So, you know, what's Babar's problem? Then I thought back to the last chair, and what we said there is that for the future, we need to keep an eye on, you know, what happens over the last year or so with Babar, because they were the first really big C++ programming environment. And they were also the first big real production Objectivity users. So I'm not quite sure what the lesson we've learned is, whether this says more about Babar or Linux. But I suspect it's Linux, right? They've had problems getting the right level of Linux, getting the software to work with all the various components of it. So it's not been trivial. I think people are starting from new with Linux and developing their code, which is, you know, a lot of the future experiments are doing, not so much a problem. But I think it says it's not a criticism of Babar. It says more about, you know, Linux's sort of robustness and suitability. CERN had a system. Well, I mean, anyone's been at CERN, you know the size of it. You know how there's printers stuck in corners and corridors everywhere on site. So managing them must be very difficult. But they've now moved to a system where, you know, the printers are all known through the DNS. They're all addressed and mapped through the DNS onto a small core of servers. So a set of servers manages all the printers. And then they have this wizard that runs under, and certainly in Windows systems, that it's effectively a database. So you've got printer types, you've got building numbers. So by selecting on that, you can come up with a list of the suitable printers. So you could just say, building, show me all printers. Then just by clicking on here, you can install that on your secure desktop machine, and install the drivers and have it in as a configuration, set it as your default if you want. So that seems to have taken away a lot of the mess of how do I get to this printer, why can I print to this one and not the one that's next to it. So that's been a useful tool. The next session on data grids, I mean, I think this has been mentioned, I won't say a lot on this, it's been mentioned in most of the sessions and in the plenaries. I think the three relevant talks we had, I just summarise the first one was on a version of Condor across INFN, and that seemed to be providing a useful resource to a fair number of people. And effectively, that's a, you know, that's a, an Italian grid. The other one was really, how is LHC going to use grid capabilities to meet its demands? And there, I think the important point is the balance of, we've heard about tier zero, tier one, tier two centres. The balance of them is perhaps important. One of the models was that, you know, a third of the computing is done at CERN. I've also heard people mention maybe only 10% of the computing is done at CERN. So what this does to the balance of the various levels of the tier, I don't know. I think we need to look into that. But at the moment, what you've got is people are saying, well, look, we've got proposals to put together tier one regional centres. But under this, you know, and they're costing millions of dollars. But under this model, you've then got to say, well, you know, for every dollar spent here, we effectively, or at least for every element of computing that's done here, storage, CPU power, etc., you've got to replicate that across all the tier one, all the tier two centres that are fed by this tier one centre. And that's certainly not negligible. I mean, it may be further down the line and you need to establish the tier one first, but certainly if you put together a, you know, a funding proposal that says we want to get to LHC and put in these tier one centres to get there, if you then got to go back later and say, well, we need double the money because of this, then you might be in trouble. The last one was a sort of local area grid thing. It was a series of using standard logging messages that you could then instrument into your code. And then there's a visualizer tool that you could show you what was happening as a function of time. So you could see where the performance problems were. You know, was it when you went off to the objectivity lock server that suddenly that took a long period of time? So it lets you get, you know, you could either use it on standard sort of things or you could actually implement it into your code. So that was a useful tool. It was designed and it's been built really just for in Babar, so local use. But it obviously it scales out to wide area grid use as well. That's just a couple of slides from Paul Avery's talk. I think most of the other things have been covered by other talks at the conference. The main one I mentioned is Globus. This is the middleware, if you like. This is the things for. This is the elements for security. Data services, that sort of thing for grid authentication. I think that's going to be an important project to follow in future. So that has been mentioned. R&D, I'll just flash through. There's a number of different talks on other subjects. Niall was certainly had evaluated CORBA and RMI and decided that since they were now all in Java, that RMI was a lot better thing to use as a repository. MIT reported on an NQS cluster that they reconfigured NQS so that they could partition it and share it between different communities or users. Okay, so that's come to a summary of various things I wanted. Lessons that we've drawn from the parallel sessions. We heard a lot about commodity hardware. Some of the software was about managing commodity hardware, so the PCs and the printers, and some of it was called commodity software like Linux. But we didn't hear much about real commodity software. Most of it was about software that was developed, not about software that we can suddenly say, let's just take this and use this across the whole community. I think we need to do that. We need to make more of the software that we're talking about. Everything you need to do shouldn't be a large development project, right? I think we need a lot more sharing and things across the HEP world. And just comment on, I mean, it may have come up under the other sessions, but I couldn't help but notice through the reports we had that three different experiments are using software release tools, which I believe started with Babar, but the other two both seem to have rewritten them. So I think three experiments need to think about, you know, is it really necessary to rewrite things? What lesson can we learn from that? And is every other experiment that wants to reuse things? I think we need developments that lead to reuse. I hope the grid will help us with this. Linux, there's a lot of work in and interest in, a lot of work on it and interest in Linux. We mentioned at last CHEP about whether we should be looking at, you know, if we're taking Linux seriously, we should be looking at, you know, becoming kernel developers. And I haven't seen any evidence of that yet. There were a number of different solutions to administration, but none of them are really perfect and going to be used everywhere yet. Most of the systems, although everyone says Linux is where all the CPU power comes from, almost all the current and upcoming experiments had something else for their data moving. So they had, you know, large disk servers and things that weren't Linux. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops over the next year or so. So my opinion is that Linux is an operating system for commodity computers. It's not a commodity class operating system. You still have to spend a lot of time, you know, configuring it for different hardware, looking at the suites of software you want to run on it. Everyone installs Linux very simply the first time, but the question is, if you then have a lot of users using it, what happens when you want to move and do an upgrade? So I think Linux is not there from that. However, it was noticeable there was very little mention of NT at all. Now, we know it's being used. It's actually being used a lot. Sorry, apologies to Fermilab. I just happened to use their overhead. But this was to show the growth in their Linux systems and the drop-off in VMS. But they completely ignored the fact that their NT systems sits at that sort of level. So why is this? I think computer centers still talk about NT and put a lot of effort into it. But I think for my opinion is that, you know, physicists to produce physics are not interested in NT. And I think that's been the main topic of this conference. So therefore, it's not mentioned at all. Not quite sure where I've disappeared to now. Oh, sorry, I seem to have lost my thread. So last two things. One was, I was very encouraged by the collaboration I'd seen at Fermilab. Now, Vicky White said yesterday that she was actually disappointed that the Run 2 experiments hadn't done more together and hadn't got everything in common. I'm actually encouraged by the fact that they've done anything together. The fact that they've, you know, their hardware development seems to have gone in line. They seem to be going to the computer center for the solutions they want. I think that's very encouraging, as is the collaboration with DAISY. Now, my co-chairman didn't bribe me to say this, but he can buy me a beer later. I think we need more of this. I think we need more of experiments sharing software. We need more of them doing common developments together, and not just experiments, but laboratories as well. So the one thing I noticed from earlier in the week, and Harvey mentioned this yesterday, was that certainly the reports we had through our session about the remote use of data showed that when people were putting together the system, it wasn't their prime concern. It wasn't, you know, even very high on the priority as to what the outside institutes did about data. Is there any way of passing the data across the network? Now, I think the grid will help with that. It's just worth noticing the Jefferson Lab experience. They actually planned to send the data out to all the institutes for analysis, and in fact, it never happened. So I think we perhaps need to look into the reasons for that. But certainly LHC, Monarchs and the grids are the right way to go, but I think it still needs to be a high priority in the total experiments thinking. So, future, last slide or so. Operating systems, Linux, yeah, probably, but it's not there completely yet. It's there for compute farms, it's not there for everything, it's not there for all the I.O., for all the data management. Hardware, it's going to get cheaper, well, compute power will get cheaper and more powerful, the disk will get cheaper and higher density, and the tape will get higher density, but probably not cheaper. I think the question is, For Run 2, for RIC and things, I think they can see the forecast. They can see how dear it actually will be, whether it will meet their requirements. I think LHC, it's probably too soon to tell. You know, you can do a projection to 2005, 2006, 2020, but, you know, I don't think it's that believable. So the question is, you know, will it be enough? I think probably, but the strength is that the power of the commodity computing is that you can just scale up. If you've got the money is the issue. You can put it in, but the main thing is the design correct? So I think my hope for the future is that both computer centres and experiments can share more. There's some encouraging signs of that, so I'll come back to the next chap and hope that I see a lot more. Okay, thanks.
There are questions. I think we can thank Dawn again.